Wake up, Citibank.
Need to get my act together. Surely, I can do better.
You can do better when you partner with the experts. Citigold Wealth Management. Get the partnership working.
The new working partnership for Citigroup involves a federal bailout, another weekend deal, another bank finds a home in the U.S. Treasury. The city that never sleeps just went into a coma. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
It's Monday, November 24th, and as you said, another weekend and another bank bailout.
Good morning, Adora.
This hour, we'll take a look at developments in the world economy. We'll look at billions of dollars of fraud on the internet and the contradictions of consumers. We want to save money when we actually spend more money. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
Citigroup is the latest customer at the government ATM. The government will pump $20 billion into the troubled financial firm, also on offer guaranteeing hundreds of billions of dollars in high-risk loans. For its money, the government gets shares in Citibank. We'll talk in depth about the importance of this deal in just a moment. The government will also need to set aside more money for an economic stimulus package. President-elect Barack Obama proposed an additional $175 billion to stimulate the economy during the campaign. His team now says that's too small. And so does House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
The economy has worsened, and economists tell us we need something in the several hundred billion dollar category.
The president-elect is expected to introduce key members of his economic team this afternoon. Top players include Timothy Geithner as Treasury Secretary and Larry Summers as head of the National Economic Council. The current economy is putting the brakes on Thanksgiving travel, according to AAA. Spokesman Troy Green says many Americans are simply staying home.
We are projecting that 41 million Americans will travel during this Thanksgiving holiday travel season, and that's down 1.4% compared to last year.
People are staying put in spite of the lowest gas prices in 3 years. Prices for regular have slipped below $2 a gallon around the country.
At least 20 people are dead after a string of brutal attacks in Baghdad today. Three separate attacks came as the Iraqi parliament prepares to vote Wednesday on a controversial security pact that would allow U.S. troops to stay in Iraq through 2011.
Asian markets were down. Key European indexes are up 3 to 4%. The Dow and S&P both rallied Friday. Futures trading shows investors betting on a positive opening for Wall Street today.
Futures up about 2%. So in this tough economy, you're still buying items that don't make sense, right?
I increased my kids' allowance to $200 a month, but they pay the electrical bill. So that encourages them to turn off lights, turn off things that use electricity.
That's a good
brilliant.
One.
That is brilliant. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We're exploring economic irrationality in these times. As you try to change your behaviors, you discover that you have some things that you really won't let go of, and the reasons aren't rational.
But the father there is injecting some rationality in his kids' behavior. So they get more money, but if you use more lights, that means you're going to have less money in your pocket to spend.
Yeah,
interesting. We want to hear your thoughts and ideas and your strategies. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. It wouldn't be a Monday without another cataclysmic economic headline to speak of. And this morning, $20 billion from the Federal Treasury has been pumped into Citigroup. It's one of the world's largest banks. It has operations in 100 countries. The little bit of a commercial that we aired at the top of the program is an Indian commercial for Citigroup. Andrew Walker joins us, BBC Economics correspondent. He's in London. Andrew, thanks for being a part of the program.
Pleasure.
We see Citigroup operating in 100 countries around the world. It is a bellwether of what, do you think, as far as the global economy is concerned?
It's an enormous operation, isn't it? I mean, the figure that really struck me was the scale of the assets that it claims in its accounts. Something over $2 trillion, which is the same sort of order of magnitude as the annual production of a moderately large developed economy like the UK or Italy, for example. So, yeah, I mean, it's a very clear marker of the general problems that the global financial industry is in. If Citigroup is in trouble, then I think it's the classic example of the bank that is just too big to fail.
Lose Citigroup, you lose Italy. That's interesting. Scaling almost... there. Well, so the question then is the mechanics of this bailout likely to succeed in sheltering Citigroup from all of these toxic assets? And we actually don't know what they all are based on what you've seen so far.
It's not going to shelter them from all of it, because actually one of the striking things about the proposals is that the federal government is going to give some guarantees on a pool of assets, a lot of the mortgage-based assets worth $306 billion. But the first $29 billion of losses are actually going to accrue to Citigroup. So, you know, the damage is by no means over. But with the extra government capital and with the guarantees of containing additional losses beyond that $29 billion, it's clearly going to help Citigroup a lot. And I think there's some evidence of that in electronic pre-market trading in the share price, which has moved up a bit. I mean, it's still way, way down on where it was just a week or so ago, but it is up on Friday's close.
Yeah, but Andrew, is it just about the money? Isn't then the next question the leadership and what's going to be done with the money? If the market is not showing confidence in the way that the leadership has been handling things, why does it make it any different now if they just get more money?
It's a fair point, of course. The way the business is run is terribly important, and there's been a lot of pressure on the chief executive, Vikram Pandit. I dare say that will continue, but you know, it is partly about the finance. If the markets are convinced that one way or another Citigroup is going to be able to get its hands on the resources to ensure that it can cover the further losses that it presumably is going to make, then it will survive. But yeah, sure, who knows? It could well be under new leadership.
Well, quickly, there are two things to watch then. Number one, will Citigroup begin lending with this money that's been given to them, or are they going to hoard it? And number two, AIG, which was equally sort of taken over by the federal government, confidence has not returned to the stock of AIG. So it's hard to know if this Treasury plan is going to help.
Yeah, it certainly is. I think one sign of some degree of confidence, I guess, in Citigroup, of course, is that as a deposit-taking institution, as a conventional retail bank, there's, as far as I'm aware, no great reports of a big run on deposits, of course, helped by the fact that there is a federal government guarantee on the first $250,000 worth of deposits. But, you know, of course, there is there's no question that we still have every sign of the problem in the U.S. housing market continue. House prices likely to fall further. That presumably means more mortgages turning bad, and Citigroup and the others are going to take more losses on them.
And that has impacts all over the world. Is there any particular place in the world that has more of an impact than elsewhere?
You mean Citigroup's problems?
Citigroup's problems, or if it were to cease operations?
It's pretty widespread. You can.
So there's no specific place to watch.
I wouldn't watch any specific place. Right. I would say it is so big that if Citigroup went down, we would be looking at problems in financial sectors just about everywhere. Major developed economies that are integrated into international financial markets.
As you said, it'd be like losing Italy, and we'd all feel that loss. Andrew Walker, BBC economics correspondent, thanks you for joining us from London. And now joining us to give a better sense of who may end up in President-elect Barack Obama's cabinet as far as economics is concerned, the personality we've seen emerging over the last week, is Jody Cantor, who is a reporter for The New York Times, who's been covering develops in the transition team, and Marcus Mabry, international business editor at The New York Times, joins us in the studio. Marcus, thanks for being with us.
Pleasure being here.
Let's start with what do we make of the personalities from the Clinton sort of team? What does that say about Obama's suggestion that he's going to change things? A lot of talk over the weekend was that, you know, this doesn't represent change.
Well,
I think the thing to remember is that the Clinton administration was a big place, and people had a lot of diverse experiences there. One thing I'm looking forward to asking some of these people in interviews is really what their time in government was like, because I don't think it was a unified experience at all. Also, it just shows that Obama is not really interested in taking risks right now. The economy is too precarious. He's reaching out to people who are known performers, who are well known in the Democratic community and have worked in the White House in Washington before.
And Jody, among all those familiar names, though, your front page story about Valerie Jarrett points out influence of someone who is not as well known nationally. Tell us what you've learned about the kind of skills that she's going to bring to the White House and in some ways be very protective of the Obamas, who she's very close to.
Well, that's what's so interesting about Valerie. We have all of these names who are so familiar and fairly trusted figures, and people have served for government for years and years and years. And Valerie Jarrett is kind of the outsider member of the administration. She is a Chicago civic leader and businesswoman, and as you say, very, very close friend of the Obamas. The Obamas talk about her in almost maternal terms, even though she's only about 5 years older than them. And she's got a mix of roles. They're bringing her to Washington. She's got two very real jobs in very defined jobs in the White House. She'll be in charge of intergovernmental relations, so she'll be the contact for state and local officials. She's also the public liaison. She's going to try to make good on that Obama promise we've heard about so much to sort of build a channel between government and local citizens. And she'll advise Mr. Obama, but she's also being brought there a little bit as first friend.
But she's been described from people that I've spoken to in Chicago. She's got this incredible reputation for being a strong diplomat. And even in your article, you talk about how she was essentially the liaison between the Black community, the leadership, and the representatives of the Clintonites, and was there really to support Obama as he made decisions from the very beginning when he decided to run for office.
Yes, absolutely. Obama is a man of many mentors, but she is chief among them. She's part of the small group of top mentors. And I think that you're right. I mean, she's got a lot of skills, but the one that she is best known for is managing relationships. Vernon Jordan, who's actually related to her, told me that Valerie could tell somebody to go to hell and make them enjoy the trip. And Al Sharpton, Reverend Al Sharpton, has told me something else that also made me laugh. His name for her is Miss Reality, because she's very good at delivering tough news with a soft edge.
Well, that's interesting. More quotes like that will probably be coming out. Marcus Mabry, before we go in this segment, Timothy Geithner, the markets loved that appointment yesterday.
Oh, yeah. The markets loved it. The question is, as we were pointing out earlier, will the market continue to love it? The problem is the market has loved every, every move that they've made to try to shore up and restore international confidence in our markets, especially in our financial institutions. The market has initially reacted with jubilation. It's brought up what have been very down markets. But then day two or day three afterwards, we see us plummeting right back downwards. That's going to be the question. Do we see another fall like that tomorrow or day after?
Well, whatever the condition of the markets, everyone is going to be looking what in all of these appointments represents Obama's specific vision and what represents this sort of team that he's putting together. Jody Kantor, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Jody Kantor is a New York Times reporter. Her piece on the Obama Svengali, Valerie Jarrett, is on the front page of today's New York Times. And Marcus Mabry is going to stick around with us and get more into the sense of what is this team that President-elect Obama is assembling. Stay with us.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. This economy is tough, but come on, admit it. You're still expressing some irrational exuberance, buying items that don't make sense, like the $4 latte you just can't give up, or impulse buys in the grocery store aisle, you know, that $6 a pound cheese or the $60 a pound cheese. Tell us your dirty economic secrets at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
60-pound cheese?
$60.
$60, okay. All right. Well, I don't know. Good for you, John. Boy, you shop. Interesting. Anyhow, we're going to move on to President-elect Obama's potential cabinet members. Every day there's more news about who may be in or who's out. Some political watchers are asking themselves, as we see so many familiar names floated, whether or not they will really bring the change that Obama promised during the election. Marcus Mabry is with us, and we expect that President-elect Obama is going to announce his economic team today. Marcus, at the head of that would be Treasury Secretary, and that would be New York Fed Reserve President Timothy Geithner.
Geithner's a young, brilliant guy, 47, same age as Barack Obama, and he has been at the center of this maelstrom the New York Fed has been at the center of trying to defuse as international crisis has sank in our financial institution. So he could not be more steeped in the issues that they're facing right now, because he cannot be more up to speed. At the same time, he has a long history with people like Larry Summers and people like Bob Rubin, former President Clinton's Treasury Secretaries, and is a great acolyte of theirs.
And he's certainly a new face and name, at least on the national scene, for those outside of the financial world circles. But there's certainly been a lot of names that are very familiar, starting with Rahm Emanuel, John Podesta, who's leading the transitional effort. There's also Eric Holder, who many expect will be named the Attorney General. He was in the Clinton administration. So these old names triggers the question, is that change?
Well, there are a lot of those old names. As you said, Eudora, it's kind of amazing because I think in some ways it was when it was clear that Hillary Clinton would be going to state that I thought, okay, well, that means Geithner is going to be Treasury Secretary, because the other leading candidate for Treasury Secretary was indeed Larry Summers, who was Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary. And I thought they're not going to put another Clintonian from a Clinton cabinet back into an Obama cabinet with already the list they have. It's got to be Geithner. It's got to be a young, best and brightest. There is this sense growing, I think, among some progressive and some left-wing bloggers that this is not change, that this is too many old faces, too many old Clintonites from a time that they didn't particularly cherish in government, the time of triangulation, the time of political calculation, rather than principles being driven by political concerns and trying to outfox your own even Democratic allies in Congress.
Well, specifically there, I mean, if the principal disagreement between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama during the campaign was over the vote on the Iraq War and whether you would talk with world leaders without preconditions in Iran and places like North Korea, why would appointing her Secretary of State not seem very, very contradictory?
Well, John, I think some of what we're seeing here is the fact of, reality, the campaign, what was said in the campaign versus the reality. And I think it's clear, and both aides on both sides have said that the difference between them was really a lot less significant than they all played up during the campaign. For instance, I think, and these are two controversial points of view, the first one is not controversial, which is when it came to that question of when would you sit down with world leaders with whom you disagree, especially Ahmadinejad in Iran. The Clintonians made it seem like, oh, Obama's naive and he'd sit down with any horrible dictator. The McCain campaign picked up on that same theme. That was never what Obama was suggesting, and they knew that at the time. So there was some politics in there. More controversially, and again, this is my own supposition, if Barack Obama had actually been in the Senate at the time of the vote of authorizing the war in Iraq, there were some Democratic senators who actually stood up, probably Ted Kennedy famously, and said, no, I'm not going to vote for this war, for this president, because I don't trust them. Most of them, however, did exactly what Hillary Clinton did. And would Barack Obama have done otherwise? Would he have really voted against that war if he had been in the Senate rather than not have the luxury of not being in the Senate at the time?
Right. And if we all had a crystal ball and we could change the past, then we'd know the answer to that question. But I guess in this discussion about change, I'm just wondering, does change automatically have to mean new faces, or is it a question of the dynamics of the people you bring together and the leadership? And let's listen to what David Axelrod, who was obviously very prominent in bringing Barack Obama to the point of where he is, let's listen to how he described it this weekend.
People need to understand one thing. There's one person who's going to be in charge of American foreign policy, and there's one person who's going to be in charge of American economic policy, and that's Barack Obama.
That was David Axelrod on ABC's This Week yesterday, and he is going to the White House as one of the advisors to Barack Obama. And so is that really what the change is about, is the agenda that Obama is going to set and then force these big characters, these larger-than-life politicians, these very accomplished people to all meld to that mission?
I think that's right. I think the change comes from being, number one, the vision from the top. And this is a vision we haven't seen, and a vision of bipartisanship also that we have not seen. We didn't see it under Bill Clinton. We didn't see it under George W. Bush. Obama has reached out to Republicans in ways that no one has in a long, long time. This is, takes us back to politics in America that was pragmatic, that actually cared about getting results, rather than being stenched in ideology and this whole, I will not change from what the path I have started upon, blah, blah, blah. This is a return to competence and pragmatism, something we have not seen in our politics in a long time. And I think that's actually going to present real problems for the Republicans to fight against it. Because if Obama is reaching out to the center, if he's saying we're about good ideas, we're about facing a magnificent mountain of problems this country has not faced, at least probably since FDR, when you look at the military issues as well as the economic ones, I think Obama has change on his side.
Well, Wesley, what irrational purchase can't you give up, Marcus? Just we're asking everybody that.
Think about that. When you talk about that ridiculous latte, you know, I'm making myself, my partner, I make coffee every morning, and I say, you know, you will take this to work and, you know, eat these leftovers. I was thinking about moving to New Jersey.
Boy, he's tough. Marcus Mabry, editor of the New York Times International Business Section. And now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got a few headlines for us.
Thanks, Adora. The time is coming up to just about 29 minutes past the hour. President Bush met with leaders from the Asian Pacific region in Peru this weekend. The APEC conference was his last summit as president. He emphasized the importance of free trade while dealing with the economic crisis. And back in Washington, the president will meet today with another lame duck head of state, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. Establishing a peace agreement between Israel and Palestine had been a major goal of the Bush administration. It looks unlikely to happen before his term ends. A federal appeals court will decide the future of Muslim detainees being held at Guantanamo Bay. They decide whether a federal judge may release the Chinese prisoners known as Uyghurs. They were cleared for release 5 years ago, but face torture if sent back to China. And the Bush administration opposes their release. Gas prices are down below $2 a gallon for the first time in more than 3.5 years. The National Lomborg survey says that it's fallen 33 cents in the last 2 weeks. And so the cheapest gas is since Louis, and that's at $1.89.
And they still estimate driving is going to be down for the Thanksgiving holiday.
Yeah.
Thanks, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. The economy is tough, but the question is, are you still buying items that make no sense? Well, Chuck says, not wise, but booze benders. That's what I spend
I spend over $100 a week, every once in a while I spend $100 on that, 1 to 2 times a week on drinks for friends and me, Chuck says, to stave off the reality that we are all becoming part of a third world country. What are you buying that might not make a lot of economic sense, but you can't give up? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
And now we're going to turn to the issues of gender equality in politics. Moving forward after a precedent-setting primary and presidential election with Senator Hillary Clinton in the race for the Democratic nomination and Governor Sarah Palin, the first to run as a vice presidential candidate on the Republican side, some are wondering if you look deeper, if the race actually stirred up and reinforced stereotypes that persist to this day. Amanda Fortini, a writer for New York Magazine, joins us with her take on modern-day gender equality. Good morning, Amanda.
Good morning.
And Marcus Mabry, the international business editor from The New York Times, is still with us, so welcome.
Thank you.
Can you explain, Amanda, your basic premise of the article you wrote?
Sure. The basic premise, I mean, I guess it's pretty simple that, you know, the campaign, the election season sort of brought to the fore these pernicious stereotypes that, you know, we tend to hold about women. They tend to be a sort of duality. You've got the kind of hard-nosed, hard-working, you know, bitch, for lack of a better word, on the one side, and then the sort of ditzy airhead type on the other, and that that this election reinforced those. I mean, that was basically the premise of the article.
And how do you measure that? Is it a question of how the press covers them, or is it a question of how the voters or Americans view them?
Well, I think in terms of Hillary, we saw... Pardon me. We saw a lot of this with the press coverage. You know, it was quite sexist, and a lot of people have commented on it. You know, with Chris Matthews calling her the grieving widow of absurdity and various things like that. But I think we also saw it among voters on the internet. For instance, there was a Facebook page, you know, saying, "Stop running for president and make me a sandwich," or the people yelling, "Iron my shirts." I mean, I think we saw it kind of across the board.
But having said that, when you take a look at what Senator Clinton accomplished, 18 million votes, she raised tens of millions of dollars, and she was the first woman who was expected at the very onset of the primary process to actually take the nomination.
Yes, I mean, it's not none of this is to take away from her accomplishments, which were extraordinary. It's just to point out how difficult it is even to sidestep, you know, these roles that women are so, you know, sort of funneled into, basically.
And so how should these things be addressed?
Well, I think for one, you know, one of the arguments that I made in the article is that the most sort of pernicious thing was that Sarah Palin put herself forward, you know, when she was not really qualified for the position. So I think that would be one thing, is that perhaps she should have, you know, considered that before she accepted the nomination. And also, I think...
But wait a second, though, Amanda, just to ask you about that. But isn't that part of what modern-day equality is about, that there's equal opportunity for men or women to choose to embark on whatever journey in their career that's open to them if they choose to?
Sure, she could choose to, but I think before you accept a position, you should examine whether or not you have the qualifications and experience to fulfill that position.
Well, you know, we can embellish our resumes all we want. When it's done in public, it's a whole different thing, and you get on Saturday Night Live doing it, that's for sure. Amanda, do you think that there's a process here whereby these gender stereotypes are being purged from the American psyche rather than reinforced, that somehow the circulation of these characters in this election in such a high-profile way means that we won't return to them in the same way in an election of the future?
Well, I hope that we don't, and I hope that they are being purged, and I think that they are, and I think that, you know, the recent appointment of Clinton to Secretary of State is going to go a long way toward that, and, you know, I think being aware of them and speaking out against them is one step toward purging them. I don't think just addressing them, saying that they exist, is reinforcing them, which is what some people have said. But merely to sort of utter them is you know, reinforces these stereotypes.
And Marcus, Amanda makes the point, and I would actually agree with her, that there was certainly a tone of sexism in the way that we in the press covered Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton.
I think it's true. I think it's interesting. One of the things that we hear a lot about when we speak about Obama and his campaign is we talk about the fact that, you know, he's gotten this historic level because he ran a campaign that was, as we've often used the phrase, and it was the title of my book about Condi Rice, twice as good. He ran a campaign that was twice as good, despite everything was on his side about this campaign, the president's disapproval of the economy. At the same time, he was still a black candidate. And so he actually raised more money than anyone in history. He had a more disciplined campaign than anyone in history. Extraordinary for a Democrat. A better on, better get out the vote and ground campaign than anyone in history. Really extraordinary stuff. I think we're seeing the same thing from the female side. I think women in the professional world in many parts of life are used to this. They, too, have to be twice as good. And so I think Hillary's campaign wasn't twice as good, and I think that's one of the reasons she's not here. But you, in order to overcome all that
inherent sexism, it was twice as good as Kucinich's.
But I was going to say, but that's a whole nother, that's a whole nother segment, and we could certainly debate that point.
But the question I wonder about for Amanda,
about her campaign, that is.
Sure. Amanda, I wonder, do you think Hillary will face a lot of these same kind of sexist underlying questions as Secretary of State?
You know, I'm sure she probably will face them. I mean, they're hard to avoid. But I think that the more that we see women out there, you know, in powerful positions, in high-level positions, doing the job well. I mean, it's harder to stereotype mm-hmm. people when you see them in more nuance and full color. You know, so I think that that seeing a lot of her, seeing her do her job, will do much to.
Amanda Fortini, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Amanda Fortini is a writer for New York Magazine, and we also want to thank Marcus Mabry from the New York Times for joining us today, too. And now we turn to Femi Oke, who's got some headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 20 minutes to the top of the hour. There's another bailout in the works. This one is for bank giant Citigroup. The government will invest $20 billion in the company directly. They'll also back up more than $300 billion worth of securities and loans. At least 23 people have been killed in a series of bombings in Iraq. One attack killed 13 government employees traveling on a government bus in Baghdad. And shortly after that, a female suicide bomber blew herself up near a green zone checkpoint. And then a roadside bomb targeted a police patrol in the city's east in a third attack. The Iraqi parliament is planning to vote on Wednesday about a security pact that would allow Americans to stay in the country for three more years. The proposed deal has new limitations on American rights in Iraq. Let's look at some of the main stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And think of it this way. We all got together and decided to lend $5 billion to a bunch of thieves. Give them a credit line. That's the idea. Joining us now is Richard Cox, credit card fraud expert and chief information officer for Spam House. He joins us from London to talk about a study that the company Symantec did where they observed credit card fraud online, and as we get into this holiday season, and observed that based on, you know, their research for an entire year, it amounts to a $5 billion credit line for a bunch of thieves who are doing pretty darn well. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
What do you think of that? I mean, there was a time when $5 billion seemed like a big number to people like you and me, but that's no longer the case. Nevertheless, what do you think of the scale of this fraud as the study has unearthed it?
I think they've unearthed the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot more behind it. The problem with the credit card fraud, of course, is it never gets paid back, and that it's so easy to do. The banks are seeing it as a cost of doing business. Law enforcement doesn't really have the initiative to follow up on the majority of cases. They are, after all, a key part of organized crime in various parts of the world. Criminals are not usually in the US, they're most commonly in Russia. And therefore, it's very difficult for law enforcement to follow up.
And among the steps that are taken to actually enable this fraud is the buying and selling of credit card numbers online, which Symantec in its study actually observed. How does this work?
Well, quite simply, there are, if you like, wholesalers who will sell a batch of numbers which they've bought from the various people who suck them in from their keyloggers. Your keyloggers sit on people's private PCs. The users don't know they're there, but they log everything that's typed. They send that off to the owner, as it were, of that keylogger, who keeps that list and sells it.
Now, the credit card companies, as you say, think of this as a cost of doing business, and so they don't necessarily want to do anything that's going to make it harder to process credit card transactions. They'll just add fees and raise the interest rate, right?
Well, over here they are doing something, but I noticed how easy it was to use my credit card in the US recently compared with using it here. There are checks on these things, and it's working. And the internet industry is also trying to stamp it out, but we're worried that the new proposed legislation by Senator Obama could actually make that impossible.
Now, he's an advocate of net neutrality. Explain what that means and how it would make credit card fraud more difficult to police.
Well, net neutrality in his mind is whether anybody can get equal access to the internet via any other provider. And it came about because some phone companies were saying, well, hey, you can't do voice over IP on our internet because you're competing with us. And that's exactly what Senator Obama wants to stop. But if he writes a bill that's going to make it possible for one person to say, I have to give you service, I don't have any option, then the criminals are going to demand service. The criminals are going to get connected.
And it's going to be more easy for fraudulent companies to be created online and vanish and be recreated
and
the next day.
We, the industry, are the only people who are able to police this, as I said, because law enforcement doesn't. A couple of weeks back, the Mercolo site was taken out of service by the internet itself, by engineers and security people in adjacent networks. They could see the harm that was going on. And overnight, the volume of spam hitting your mailbox would drop by over 50%. Now, if that sort of impact can be had by one co-location center, and if we end up with a law that forces networks to take traffic from that co-location center, we're in big trouble.
All right. Well, Richard Cox, in time for this holiday season, it doesn't seem as though there's going to be anything to reduce fraud for this shopping season. But as you say, sober trends for retailers online. Richard Cox is credit card fraud expert and chief information officer for Spam House. Thanks for joining us, Richard.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, November 24th, and Femi Oke has joined us with headlines.
Hello there. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Bush has a final meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert today. Both men are on the way out. President Bush because of term limits and Olmert forced out after a long corruption trial. Both sides admit that the goal of Israeli-Palestinian peace by the end of the year won't happen.
That's the perfect thing for two lame duck leaders to conclude.
They're
it's
not
a lame duck summit
it.
And they conclude that they can't do anything. I love that. Thank you.
But
keep going.
Duck is very tasty. Right. Good news for drivers as the Thanksgiving holiday weekend approaches. Gas prices have dipped below $2 a gallon for regular gas, and they haven't sunk below that level since 2005. And in hours, it will be official. President-elect Barack Obama names the top members of his economic team this afternoon. And the names have been out there, but the transition team wanted to make them official to reassure markets. Timothy Geithner will head up the Treasury Department. Larry Summers will head the National Economic Council. There's been a setback for the controversial and colourful Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. His foes are celebrating gains in local elections there. The opposition took several states, but Chavez's party still commands a majority nationwide. And finally, after a 17-year wait, the new Guns N' Roses album, Chinese Democracy, is out. And today, the Chinese state media-sponsored newspaper has released its review of the CD. The headline reads, American band releases album venomously attacking China. And the story also complains about the album turning its spear point on China. Plus, there are lots of rumours surrounding the album on fansite, including one about there being a secret message in the lyrics if you play the CD backwards. So our producer Jim Colgan tried it. This is what we ended up with.
And that signifies what exactly?
It's secret codes to the Chinese people.
Urging them to...
complain about their current situation and state of the politics.
I see. I guess we'd call that Guns N' Roses diplomacy. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
So economics, I would say economics, folks, not Guns N' Roses, is fundamentally rational, right? That's what we're told. We're deluded to think that economics is rational, but no, you're wrong. It's not. We all make crazy decisions. We stick with spending decisions that are insane, macro and micro. And here to talk about it is Gary Belsky, author of Why Smart People Make Big Money Mistakes and How to Correct Them, Lessons from the New Science of Behavioral Economics. And family manager Kathy Peel joins us from St. Petersburg, Florida. She's the founder of the Family Manager Coaching Service and author of The Busy Mom's Guide to a Happy, Organized Home. Kathy, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
And Gary's here in the studio with us. So tell us a great irrationality story that you observed.
One of my favorite irrational spending or economic decisions is actually not a singular phenomena. It's a national phenomena, which is that it's called mental accounting, which is the tendency for people to treat money differently depending on where it's kept or where it's from or how it's spent. The greatest example being the average American has several thousand dollars in emergency funds and several thousand dollars in credit card bills. The emergency funds on average earn about 3 or 4% at the most in a bank, and the credit cards cost them about 18 or 19%. And people essentially are losing, for every $1,000, about $140 a year because they need to have emergency savings as something other than credit card availability. But the truth is almost anything you would need that you would need to spend for in an emergency, you can use a credit card unless it's a loan shark or something like that. But if you need to have emergency savings, just use your credit card, pay it off, the balance, and then you will be saving about $140 a year.
And knowing you have the emergency funds causes you to actually go farther into debt. Kathy, you know, having an organized home is something I dream of every day. How can you help me with that financially?
Well, the family manager system teaches people to run their home with business strategies, and it works tremendously. Not that we're trying to turn it into a corporate environment, but it does help to see you have a financial department and a home and property department, etc. I'm finding a lot of, especially moms, that's pretty much who I talk to, write to, that they're taking this challenge head on, and a lot of them are thinking creatively. Now, I have heard of some bloopers, like a mom I spoke to last week. She had an Angora sweater. She'd paid $200 or $300 for, and she was determined to say, okay, we're going to cut back on our dry cleaning bill. So she washed the sweater, and it shrunk to child size. But now in her desire to just, you know, be very frugal, she took it to a resale shop and is trying to sell it as a child-sized sweater. But, you know, I'm finding that the attitude is I'm not hearing much complaining. I'm hearing creative thinking for the most part.
Well, in our house, the financial manager took all of my credit cards away. So that's how it works in our house. How do you go from an irrational sort of strategy, Gary, to a rational strategy if you have all of these kinds of weird behaviors that you're unwilling to give up?
Well, one of the basic principles of behavioral economics is a concept called framing, and a lot of times it's about looking at a decision or an action that you take or a habit that you have from another light. So a lot of people, for example, have a hard time selling losing stocks or selling losing mutual funds because they sort of can't get over the what's called loss aversion. So another way of looking at it is to decide tomorrow, would I buy that stock at the price it is now? And if the answer is no, then there's no reason to actually continue owning it because the only thing you're paying, the only cost there is the transaction cost of the commission. And so almost always looking at a habit from the other side will help people overcome what might less be a rational behavior as much as it is obsolete behavior. A lot of the theory behind behavioral economics is our brains evolved to make decisions on the savanna or in a jungle, and that a lot of the decisions we have to make as adults in a modern world aren't necessarily applicable to what we might have had to make 10,000 years ago. And so the decisions aren't crazy that we make, they're just simply obsolete. They're not relevant anymore. Mm.
10,000 years ago, that would be a long time ago. Kathy, question for you. What is the most common resistance you run into in helping families get on the right road?
I think it's how can I help my children get on the team? Because they've grown up, many of them, in families where they think money is printed in ATM machines. And so I suggest to parents that they have a family meeting, schedule it sometime when there's not a favorite show or, youth activity on, and sit down and talk about it. I mean, mom and dad's attitude is just, it's critical here. And talk about how everybody's going to, we've got to cut back. And then as far as the ATM habit goes, I really suggest to people they decide how much money they need either for 1 week or two. Put the money in an envelope in a safe place and put it with a pen or pencil, and anybody who has to get money out has to write down what they get.
That stuff works. Well, my wife just texted me and said, I didn't take your credit cards, Charlie. You gave them up because you were so bad. And that is true. But it was all a result of conversations and discussion about how to get on the same page about this stuff.
Yeah, I grew up actually with parents who always told us what they made for a living. My mom was a nurse and my dad was a teacher, and that was actually sort of very helpful. And what I find now with families is when they're I work for ESPN, actually, as you know. I generally come on here to talk about sports, and there's always cost-saving initiatives where people are rewarded for coming up with ways to save money in a corporate level. It actually works for families too, right? Where if there's a family with several kids and the kids are incentivized to sort of come up with ways that we can save money.
Suggestion box?
Exactly. Well, actually, a contest, really, and the winner will get something. But in fact, what ends up happening is you co-opt the kids into being part of the solution, and it ends up being a game or a competition, which generally works much better than we have a problem and we need to sort of fix this and you guys can't spend as much money.
Love that idea. I love it.
Well, guys, it's been great. You know, we're going to actually collect ideas from our listeners as to their irrational spending habits and how they went about changing them. So this story is going to continue for a while. Gary, thanks so much for being with us.
Always a pleasure.
Gary Belsky is the author of Why Smart People Make Big Money Mistakes and How to Correct Them, Lessons from the New Science of Behavioral Economics. I could use some of that. And thanks to Kathy Peel, founder of Family Manager Coaching and author of The Busy Mom's Guide to a Happy, Organized Home.
I think, John, we all know the economy is tough, but what illogical purchases are you still making? We're asking for your help. We want your story. What are you still buying?
That third refrigerator. You don't need
the one that you don't need. For example, Gretchen writes on our website, yesterday I bought a Wii and Dance Dance Revolution 2 with dance pad included. I don't have kids and really could have saved the cash for my wedding, which is about 10 months away, but I never used my $75 a month gym membership. And after working up a real sweat at a friend's house on this thing, I figured that ultimately it works out to a savings of about $500.
Oh, that is some convoluted reasoning. I love it. Here's how New York Times business editor Marcus Mabry is logical about his purchases.
When we talk about ridiculous latte, you know, I'm making myself my partner. I make coffee every morning, and I say, you know, you will take this to work and eat these leftovers. I was thinking about moving to New Jersey.
He's the hard one. He's the hard one in that household.
Tough.
Yes,
he says, bring that coffee with you. We want to hear how you're coping, what your strategy is, and how you're maybe a bit contradictory in the way you're spending and saving. 877-8 my take or my take at thetakeaway.org. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Could we just think of it as problem gambling?
Is someone you know preoccupied with gambling? Or gambling to escape? Are they hiding their gambling? Or unable to stop? Problem gambling plays tricks with the mind. Treatment can break the spell. Call for help.
Some problem gambling at Citibank sent the mega bank to the U.S. Treasury for treatment over the weekend. Ever lose a couple $100 billion in Vegas and have to call your dad for a bailout? The city didn't sleep much this weekend. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, November 24th. And no, I've never made that phone call to my dad because there would be a resounding click on the other end.
Just 100 million, Dad.
Good morning, Adora.
Today, we're going to take a look at President-elect Obama's team, those charged with fixing the economy, and America's briefing book, a look at what the world will think if there's a Secretary of State named Hillary Clinton. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
Thanksgiving isn't until Thursday, but Citigroup isn't waiting to gorge itself, in this case on public money, the mashed potatoes for them. The government will pump $20 billion into the failing financial firm. Also on the menu, federal guarantees for hundreds of billions of dollars in high-risk loans. In exchange, Citigroup gives the government stock shares and will stick to certain limits on spending. Stimulating the economy will also cost a fortune. President-elect Barack Obama proposed a $175 billion stimulus package during his campaign, but his aides now say that's too small. So does Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer.
Most economists say to make this work, you need about 5% of GDP, which would be $700 billion. I think we need a large one.
The president-elect is expected to introduce key members of his economic team this afternoon. Top players include Timothy Geithner as Treasury Secretary and Lawrence Summers as head of the National Economic Council. Some good news for drivers. Gas prices have dipped below $2 a gallon for regular. They haven't gone under that mark since 2005. But even with cheaper gas, the economy is putting the brakes on Thanksgiving travel. AAA spokesman Troy Green says many Americans will just stay home.
We are projecting that 41 million Americans will travel during this Thanksgiving holiday travel season, and that's down 1.4% compared to last year.
The rest of them are going to go in a sleigh like they used to do in the old days. At least 23 are dead after a string of brutal terror attacks in Baghdad. The strikes came as the Iraqi parliament prepares to vote Wednesday on a controversial security pact that would allow U.S. troops to stay in Iraq through 2011.
Asian markets dropped today. European markets are now opened and up for the day. The Dow and S&P both rallied Friday on news that Timothy Geithner was the pick for Treasury Secretary. Futures trading shows investors betting on a positive opening for Wall Street in just under a half hour.
Just take a look inside yourself, folks. Is there a tiny little Karl Rove dying to get out and advise the GOP on what its future is? Don't answer that. But today's your chance to play political consultant for the Republican Party that obviously had some setbacks during the most recent election. Whether
you're
a Republican,
about a tiny David Axelrod?
There you go. You have a huge David Axelrod. If you're a Republican, Democrat, or independent, what's your advice for Republicans? Axelrodian, Rovian, what's your strategy? How can the GOP get the party started again? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the...
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Boy, it's probably safe to say the Citibank did not do much sleeping over the weekend. No, the city was very much wide awake negotiating a bailout from the federal government. The Treasury Department has agreed to inject $20 billion into the financial giant Citigroup, whose stock has lost 60% last week, and went into something of a crisis over the weekend as investors watched around the world. We're joined by Henny Sender, who's a senior correspondent for the Financial Times. Henny, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You know, we were talking last week about Citigroup as a bellwether for the financial stocks generally and the big banks in the United States particularly. What does this bailout say about the viability of the rest of the financial sector that remains in private hands as we speak this morning?
Well, I think the first thing it says is, you know, better be first in line. You know, it's so bad. I mean, this is a here we go again kind of situation. You know, let's try this one for Citi. And this is massive. They are throwing so many resources at Citi. At the same time, they're saying this deal is on for anyone else whose failure would endanger the financial system. But there are banks waiting in line who think, are we going to make the cut?
I mean, I guess if you're a former executive at Lehman Brothers this morning, you're feeling pretty darn miserable. And the auto industry was in town last week in Washington trying to get some sort of a bailout, but Citigroup raises its hand and says, we're in trouble. The government moves instantaneously. What does that say to the broader economy?
Well, it says banks are so vital to the economy. Credit is the lifeblood. We cannot afford to let a bank go down. We can afford to let a steel company go down. We may be able to afford letting a car company go down. We may even have thought we could let a Wall Street firm go down. But what if it's a bank? Absolutely no way when it's a big bank like Citi. We cannot afford the ripple effects.
Hold on there, Henny. Joining us now is Peter Marici, who's an economist. Marici, he's an economist and business professor at the University of Maryland, who's a frequent contributor to this program. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
Peter, you really called this one, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at how much – they only had about $20 billion in collateralized debt obligations, so mortgage-backed securities left to write down. But yet the federal government's guaranteeing $300 billion worth of debt. As I said – the whole balance sheet at Citigroup is corrupted. The business plans are flawed. This is what happens when a compensation package drives your business plan. I mean, what's really a shame about this, a couple of things. First of all, there's no change in management. Second of all, if you have a commercial building in Manhattan and you can't pay your mortgage to Citigroup, you'll lose your building. But the Treasury is going to make up the difference on the loan. Remember, they're guaranteeing $300 billion worth of Citigroup's loans. That's absurd. So we have extreme moral hazard here. It may be that we can't let Citigroup close, not fail, close, but we didn't have to make this kind of sweetheart deal. This sends a terrible message to the country. This is basically Hank Paulson taking care of his buddies on Wall Street.
Henny Sender, what do you think about Peter's argument there?
You know, it resonates with me. I think it was not onerous enough as a package. However, having said that, you could argue that when the government said, we care about moral hazard, let's let Lehman go, the lesson was, when you're in a crisis, you can't afford to teach that. I mean, as the CFO of Citi said to me late last night, you know, this isn't about punitive. This is about saving the financial system. Lucky Citi, you know, to have messed up so royally and gotten bailed out because the larger system couldn't afford their mistakes.
Lucky.
It's not a matter of being punitive, ma'am. It's not a matter of being punitive, but rather being reasonably fair. While we couldn't let them absolutely fail, did we have to let the managers like Vikram Pandit sit there and keep his $155 million signing bonus and
well,
so forth?
Well, that's why I said your argument resonated with me,
yeah,
Peter.
I mean,
but hold on, Peter. Hold on, Peter. Henny, let me ask you about the timing. What I don't understand is toxic assets on the books of Citigroup. Everyone has known that that's the case, as it is with many banks. The question has been how much of those going to be worth as we move forward. Why is Citigroup falling apart now?
Well, you have to ask the stock market that. They could not afford to let the stock market slide anymore because all Citi's counterparties were too nervous. And while the Fed was saying to the world, we're backstopping deposits in the U.S., you know, people weren't sure abroad. I spent half of yesterday on the phone with friends of mine in Hong Kong saying, who were saying to me, should we pull our deposits from Citibank Hong Kong? So the banks unraveling was really sort of the stock market being the catalyst for that. And with the stock market, you know, voting no on Citi, you know, its share price plunge was making it impossible to raise capital in the market. There's such gridlock they couldn't sell assets. You know, it is such a mess.
All right, well, let's talk practically about a couple of the things that have been proposed here. And, Peter, I'd love your response to this if we could get it. There was discussion over the weekend that the way that these toxic assets are going to be guaranteed by the federal government is to create a toxic bank to basically pull them out from underneath the umbrella, which is looking pretty ugly these days, in the Citibank logo, and create a sort of a bank of toxic assets that then would be separately managed by the federal government. Does that make any sense to you, Peter? And Henny, I'd love to hear your response as well.
Well, my feeling is with competent bank management, that they're better managed inside the bank. And it really is an accounting operation as to whether you put them in a separate bank or you guarantee them inside the bank, as long as you have a clear red line around what is included and not included. To me, that was more window dressing, is that whether you put it in a separate bank or not. The trick is to get those things off their books in some way so that Citigroup can continue doing the things that we need it to do.
Well, Henny, then the question is, what's coming down the pike? There was also discussion over the weekend that securitized credit card obligations are the next sort of toxic asset to hit Citibank. And if that is the case, it could be worth a lot more than we've even seen to this point.
Well, interestingly enough, credit card loans are not part of this deal. They wanted to establish a template with Citi that could be applied to other banks, and other banks don't nearly have the problems with credit cards that Citi does. What they tried to do with this deal is say to Citi, we're giving you so much capital and we're getting rid of so many problems that you will have excess capital. So please go into the market and start lending again. And you know what? All of these assets aren't terrible. Go into the secondary market, buy some of them, hold them for a while, make a little money, help us break the logjam. And, you know, everybody is holding their breath. I will be very interested to see how the stock market greets this news when it opens in a couple of hours.
Henny, why is there not more pressure, as Peter noted, for upper management to step aside?
Well, that is an interesting question. I think they felt that the management team is not up to the job, but there is no clear plan B for management. And what do you do if A management team isn't worth it, but there's no clear B management team? And I think that was their problem that idea.
I suspect that the management is probably not feeling terribly secure this morning at Citigroup, even though there hasn't been anything specifically said about this gang.
Totally agree with you, Peter.
Peter and Henny, final question. You know, the analysis of the Depression has always been, back in the late 1920s and early 30s, that ignoring the banks and focusing exclusively on labor and manufacturing was a mistake and prolonged the Depression. We're certainly not making that mistake this time around, but it seems like we're ignoring Main Street at the expense of the banks. Peter?
Well, I'd say so. That's absolutely correct. An important part of this problem was the banks. Another important part of the problem was the impact of the overvalued currency against the Asian export platforms like China and its effect on manufacturing in the Midwest. Now, I know Detroit, like Citigroup and the others, have made a lot of bad management mistakes, but also they've been laboring under an overvalued currency vis-a-vis Asian suppliers for some time now.
And that's snapping back. That's snapping back right now.
Well, no, it's not snapping back with regard to the Asian. Well, it's hurting them.
Yeah.
Is what I'm getting at is that the stronger fall in the dollar over the last couple of years has not been against those currencies, and the Treasury has refused to do anything about it. I mean, China's intervening at a pace of $700 billion a year to sustain an undervalued yuan.
The question
That's
is the
a
timing.
Huge amount of money.
Yeah, the question is the timing. Henny, I'll give you the last word. Quickly.
I think the relevant role model is Japan in their lost decade in the 90s. And what you learned there is as long as the financial sector is sick, the real economy cannot be healthy.
Well, let's not lose a decade here in the United States. Henny Sender from the FT, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And, of course, Peter Morici of the University of Maryland. Thanks, Peter.
Take care.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
In the great chess game of politics, it's perhaps safe to say that the Republican Party is feeling a little checkmated right now.
I'm a Democrat, but my advice to the Republican Party would be to stop the cultural wars. Stop worrying about gays and stop worrying about right to choose and just talk about small government and taxes.
and you know, go back to the original philosophy of the Republican Party.
Give the GOP some advice at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
We're going to turn to America's briefing book for President-elect Obama. And today we look at diplomacy. It's been widely reported that Senator Hillary Clinton will accept the position as Secretary of State in the Obama administration. We're wondering, what message does that send to the world, and what issues are at play in a post-Bush era? For that, we turn to Joseph Nye, who is the Sultan of Oman Professor of International Relations at Harvard University. Welcome, Professor.
Nice to be with you.
So the appointment, let's say, assume this happens, the appointment of Senator Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, what's the message to the world there?
Well, I think she'd be a great Secretary of State, and I think what the president-elect is trying to do is show that he wants a powerful person to represent the United States, and it doesn't hurt that you'll have somebody who's attractive in the rest of the world. President Obama himself did a lot to recover America's soft power, is our ability to attract others. And I think that Hillary Clinton will add to that.
How do you reconcile some of the differences that they both highlighted during the primary process? Let's take Iran, for example, and Senator Clinton's vote to consider the Revolutionary Army as a terrorist organization.
I think these differences in the campaign are not going to be all that important when it comes to running the State Department or running American diplomacy. Hillary Clinton is a very smart woman. She knows that for a successful period as Secretary of State, she can't allow any distance to grow between herself and the president.
Professor Nye, one of the legacies of the Bush administration, though, is a diminishing of the stature of the Secretary of State, both in terms of its ability to control funds in the Treasury. I mean, we saw certainly in the first Bush term that the Pentagon massively outweighed the State Department in its sort of profile around the world. And secondly, you know, the fact that the Bush administration didn't pay much attention to diplomacy. What kind of a role, what kind of a position is Hillary Clinton inheriting here?
Well, I think it's true that that the first issue on President-elect Obama's agenda is going to be the economic crisis. And that obviously means Treasury is going to play a much larger role than would normally be the case. So on economic issues, Treasury is going to outweigh State. On security issues, defense issues, I don't think you're going to see the kind of situation where President Bush relied so heavily on Rumsfeld and Cheney that he cut out Colin Powell. I think, on the contrary, you're going to see with a strong figure in State and with the experience of the Bush period that State will play a major role.
So you think some of the diminishment will reverse itself in an Obama administration? You talked about soft power, obviously contrasted to hard power. How do you think those two combinations need to play themselves out given the kind of issues America faces today?
Well, you're going to need some of both. I mean, it's not that soft power replaces hard power. When you're dealing with the Taliban in Afghanistan, President-elect Obama has said that he's going to put two more combat brigades there. And we still have a tough slog going on in Iraq, even though the sense of direction seems a bit clearer now. So we're going to need hard power and plenty of it. But what soft power, the ability to attract people, does is create an enabling environment. Others are more willing to work with you because they're more attracted to you. So I think he's going to get better cooperation from allies, whether they be NATO or in other countries, as a result of the ability to combine these two dimensions of power.
Do you see an early channel between the United States and the Taliban, the United States and Iran, and the United States in North Korea under a Hillary Clinton State Department?
Well, Barack Obama said that he wanted to have negotiations with Iran prepared, but without the preconditions that hampered the Bush administration. I suspect that will happen. North Korea is a bit tougher. There is already a framework, the so-called six-party talks, but right now the North Koreans are going through a sulk, and it's not clear what their behavior is going to be, but I'm afraid it's going to be on her agenda or his agenda fairly soon. So, and on Afghanistan, when we talk about talks with the Taliban, it's one thing to talk about groups or individuals. Mullah Omar, the head of the Taliban, has rejected the ideas of talks. I don't see a sitting down for a peace treaty with the Taliban as a group.
And last question, Professor. Do you think that assigning Hillary Clinton to the State Department, is that a notion of change? And how does that play with a President Obama elect or President elect Obama's theme that got him into office?
Well, I think that he is the representative of change. After all, he is the person who was elected president. But the sign that he's willing to have a strong person in state, a person who is popular in many other parts of the world, I think that shows that you're going to have not just the symbolism of change that he accomplished in the campaign, but a team that's able to implement it.
Professor Joseph Nye, we appreciate your thoughts this morning.
Good to be with you.
Professor Joseph Nye is the Sultan Oman Professor of International Relations at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Quite a mouthful there. Now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got the headlines.
Thank you, Adoa. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. President Bush will meet today with another leader who's on his way out, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. Establishing a peace agreement between Israel and Palestine had been a major goal of the Bush administration, but it looks unlikely to happen before his term ends. A federal appeals court will hear arguments today about seven Muslim detainees being held at Guantanamo Bay. They decide whether a federal judge may release the Chinese prisoners known as Uyghurs. They were cleared for release years ago but face torture if sent back to China. And the Bush administration opposes their release. The Georgian and Polish presidents have accused Russian troops of firing near a motorcade traveling close to the breakaway republic of South Ossetia. No one was injured, but President Mikhail Saakashvili of Georgia condemned the attack on his official motorcade.
Clearly, it was intended as a provocation. Certainly, I would never intend to put the life of President of Poland in danger. That was none of my intentions. But the reality is that, you know, you are dealing with unpredictable people.
Russia has denied being involved in the gunfire. Children born in autumn are more prone to asthma. A study led by researchers at Vanderbilt University found that they had an almost 30% increased risk. Children born right before winter's virus season may be more vulnerable to illnesses that weaken the respiratory system. December the 30th is your birthday, is it not, Adora?
You're looking right at me.
As she sneezes into her hanky.
Explains a lot. Thanks, Mimi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. As expected, the markets on Wall Street are open and are open positive, bouncing about 2% right at the open on both the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 in reaction to the bailout of Citigroup overnight. We wanted to consider the case of Robert Rubin this morning. He's a director of Citigroup, and on the one hand, he might not relish being a director this morning, but he certainly relishes not being Treasury Secretary anymore. I'm sure he might say he's glad he doesn't have that job, but is this the best time to be Robert Rubin or to be a protege of Robert Rubin? It's especially important to take a look at the legacy of former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin under the Clinton administration. On this morning, the President-elect Barack Obama will be naming his economic transition team. That team has ties to Robert Rubin, and what that all means is explained to us by the New York Times reporter Jackie Calmes, who joins us from their Washington bureau. Jackie, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How are you?
Now, I'm great. I guess, what would you think Robert Rubin is feeling this morning if you had to bet?
Well, I think he's feeling very satisfied at the number of acolytes that are prominent in the coming government. At the same time, I think he has his hands full with Citigroup as a director there, and it's in the middle of a bailout, and he's facing questions himself over whether he has encouraged in the recent years of prosperity before it all crashed, pushing them to make some risky investments that are now haunting them.
So thinking about his own risk management as a director of Citigroup, let's talk about his acolytes, though. You say that Robert Rubin is a mentor for at least one of the members of Barack Obama's transition team, Timothy Geithner. Describe what do you think that means?
Well, actually, Bob Rubin is the mentor for all three of what we consider the big three of Barack Obama's coming economic team. Treasury Secretary-to-be Tim Geithner, who will be announced today, was just a low-level civil servant in the Treasury Department. He actually started late in the Ronald Reagan administration, worked through the first George Bush administration, and then was in the Treasury when President Clinton came into office. And Larry Summers and Bob Rubin spied him there by the mid-90s and elevated him to a top position of Assistant Secretary for International Affairs. And he went on with Rubin's help again to be tapped after that in to be the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which is sort of the eyes and ears of the Fed on Wall Street. So he's already had a hand in the bailout there, working with Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and Henry Paulson, the current Treasury Secretary.
Now, these are described as assets for Mr. Geithner, being in the thick of things, in the middle of it all. Your colleague Marcus Mabry described on our program this morning that he doesn't need to get up to speed. He is up to speed. But what evidence is there that his style of managing the Fed in New York is reminiscent of the style of Robert Rubin's management of the Treasury?
Well, they're both, despite what I said and we mentioned at the outset about Bob Rubin now being questioned about the pushing Citigroup to be too risky and too aggressive in some of its investments of recent years. In fact, as Treasury Secretary, he was a very cautious policymaker and low-key, very affable and approachable. And Tim Geithner is all of those things as well. Tim Geithner in some quarters might be culpable, or there might be questions raised as to, this bailout hasn't exactly gone so well. It may have contained the damage from being worse than it would have been, but the $700 billion bailout package, remember, was originally written into law to be money that would be used to buy toxic bad assets off the books of financial institutions. That proved unworkable, so instead they've been using the money to just simply inject good money into these institutions, like today, mm-hmm. Citibank. But so in that time, it's thought that Tim Geithner was really a fan from the start of just capital injections as opposed to buying toxic assets.
But what about when it comes to, just to stop you there, Jackie, when it comes to the question of judgment and Lehman Brothers as to Geithner's role in that, how much do you think that's going to come up potentially as we talk about him as possibly the future Treasury Secretary?
Well, it's certain to come up at Senate confirmation hearings, and with 2020 hindsight, it's pretty well agreed that letting Lehman Brothers fail was a mistake. It destabilized the markets and probably exacerbated the financial crisis. So But it's hard to know exactly what Tim Geithner's position was in that. It was, Henry Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, who made the decision with Ben Bernanke, although, Geithner had to sign off. Now, whether it's true or not, there's a belief in the Obama camp that Tim Geithner actually was for bailing out Lehman Brothers and just was overruled.
Right. Well, Jackie, quickly, Larry Summers, who's not a behind-the-scenes character, who is a big in-front-of-the-cameras kind of character, is likely to be Barack Obama's closest economic advisor. Very quickly, what do you suspect he will be bringing to the table?
Well, he's just going to be bringing sheer brilliance, but he that's offset by a very, you know, quirky, abrasive personality that may have cost him, the chance to have a second stint at Treasury. He was a chief rival to Tim Geithner. But he's, no one doubts his brilliance. He may be in a waiting game there as a White House senior advisor, perhaps for a year from the inauguration. Ben Bernanke's term as chairman of the Fed is up, and that would have Larry Summers in a position to succeed him.
And, of course, the other person who's going to be named today is Bill Richardson, former governor of New Mexico, and also a candidate in this most recent Democratic election. Jackie Combs, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jackie Combs, New York Times, her front page piece on Robert Rubin and all the people he's mentored is in today's New York Times. We should point out it's not absolutely confirmed that Bill Richardson will be named today, so that is a little bit of suspense remaining. The Republican Party needs your advice, folks. Come on.
I'm a registered Democrat, but I think I need to tell them they just need to lighten up a little. Just relax. Loosen the tie and button the white shirt. Kick back. Might be better for them. If nothing else, they'll be a lot more comfortable.
Give the GOP some advice. Christine Todd Whitman is going to be here later in the program. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now Femi Okay with some advice about how the world is doing.
And she looks comfortable, don't you think, John?
Yes. Welcome back, Femi.
Thank you very much, you two. The time is 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Wall Street is open for business and the Dow is up around about 118, 120 points. Investors may be pleased by the government bailout of Citigroup. They invest $20 billion in the company directly. They also back up more than $300 billion worth of securities and loans. And the president has a meeting at the Treasury this morning in about, 21 minutes' time. And after the meeting, the president will make a statement about an hour from now. At least 23 people have been killed in a series of bombings in Iraq. One attack killed 13 government employees traveling on a government bus in Baghdad. And shortly after that, a female suicide bomber blew herself up near a green zone checkpoint. And then a roadside bomb targeted a police patrol in the city's east in a third attack. And the Iraqi parliament is planning to vote on Wednesday about a security pact that would allow Americans to stay in the country for 3 more years. Has a look at main stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And this is kind of a rough week for America, historically speaking. The third week in November is all about Thanksgiving, of course. But 45 years ago, the holiday planning was obliterated by a shocking event.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute.
Listen, that scratchy, barely audible sound is the only record we have of a transition of power that November 22nd, 1963, Lyndon Johnson, the vice president, taking the oath of office as president. A transition of no transition, as we reflect on this long moment of anticipation for our new president, Barack Obama, made me think of Lyndon Johnson in those horrible days after JFK was killed. Johnson was never a match for the man from Camelot, yet Lyndon Johnson had to make that most abrupt of transitions during Thanksgiving 1963. As he speaks before a joint session of Congress, his voice is tentative, humble.
All I have, I would have given gladly not to be standing here today. An assassin's bullet has thrust upon me the awesome burden of the presidency.
And the very next day, November 28th, he spoke to the American people.
All of us have lived through 7 days that none of us will ever forget. A great leader is dead. A great nation must move on.
This Thanksgiving Day address had the explicit mission of comforting a nation in mourning, a nation that had been tested. LBJ speaks here of a common sacrifice for a common purpose.
If all Americans could spend their fortunes and could give their time and spend their energies helping our system and its servants to solve your problems instead of pouring out the venom and the hate that stalemate us in progress.
Sound familiar? Johnson particularly wanted to enlist the media to help in this national healing.
Let them reflect upon their responsibilities to bind our wounds, to heal our sores, to make our society well and whole for the tasks ahead of us.
Think of it. Big ideas, a tall order from a president who had no transition team and no time to wait, just a Thanksgiving week's pause to reflect, and then back to work.
Our system has passed, you have passed, a great test. You have shown what John F. Kennedy called upon us to show in his proclamation of this Thanksgiving, that decency of purpose, that steadfastness of resolve, and that strength of will which we inherit from our forefathers.
Johnson left office in 1969 with a record of legislative victories for major social programs unmatched by any president in the latter half of the 20th century. Work that began that strange transitional Thanksgiving week 45 years ago.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
It's Monday, November 24th, and Femi Okeh has joined us with the latest headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. A federal court is now hearing the case of 17 Chinese Guantanamo Bay detainees. The prisoners are from the Uyghur Muslim ethnic minority. They've been cleared of wrongdoing, but there are fears that they'd be tortured if released to their native China. The Bush administration doesn't want them to be released. South Africa's president says that talks between warring parties in Zimbabwe will restart tomorrow. South African leaders are mediating between President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai. The two parties still haven't reached a deal on how to share power in a new government, and they've been deadlocked since the March elections. Drivers hitting the road for Thanksgiving holiday will get a little bit of a break. Gas prices have dipped below $2 a gallon for regular gas, and they haven't sunk that low since 2005. And there was a very moving reunion in London this weekend. Surviving members of the Kinder Transports, which took Jewish children out of Nazi Germany on the eve of the Second World War, well, they gathered together to talk about their experiences 70 years later. Esther Friedman was taken by train in late 1938, and this is what she remembered at the beginning of her train journey.
Anyway, we were sitting down as the train left, and next to me was sitting a little boy of four. And he looked round and he said, "Mama? Mama?" Of course, there was no mama. So I took off my number plate and I put it down amongst all that mess and I cuddled the child. And then he went to sleep.
Well, Esther was 14 when she left her home in Vienna. She left behind her 16-year-old sister and her parents and she never saw them ever again. So that was a reunion of the Kinder Transport children from the 1930s. Let's look at your news for now. Have I depressed you?
Thank you, Femi. No.
It's an amazing story, isn't it?
Yeah,
survival.
They resonate.
Yeah.
So on a very different note, the Republican Party needs your advice. Come on, folks.
Okay, Republicans, here's the plan. We tried pushing to the right. Now we're going to push to the left. Push to the left. Push those Democrats further to the left. And maybe eventually we'll all get back to what we used to call the center.
Yes, you can be the GOP's personal trainer at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And it's more than a takeaway question today. It's something that the Republican Party is truly grappling with now after the Democrats' big gains in the House and the Senate and, of course, winning of the presidency. And they're doing some soul searching that former New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman and former EPA head says was actually predictable. 3 years ago, she co-wrote the book, It's My Party Too, The Battle for the Heart of the GOP and the Future of America. In the book, she argued that the Republican Party had moved so far to the right that it could end up, quote, alienating centrist voters and marginalizing itself. She joins us now with her thoughts on the current Republican dilemma. Good morning and welcome to the show, Governor.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
So where do Republicans stand today? What does the party stand for?
Well, the party is at a crossroads, and it really has to decide whether or not it is going to define itself and its members purely on social issues, or if it's going to get back to the broader issues of governance, taxes, the keeping spending low, balanced budgets, you know, the broad issues, national security, strong defense, engaged foreign policy, and stay away from those social issues that tend to be very morally based. And it means that you can't be a national party. If you're going to decide that anybody who's a member of the party has to believe a certain way on a series of social issues, you immediately alienate a whole lot of other people because people are all over. They're not in the same place. Even a pro-life person, I had pro-life people in New Hampshire and Vermont and Iowa come up to me and say, I believe in stem cell research. Well, there are people in our party who said, you can't do that. That's not good enough. And that makes no sense.
So then how do you respond when you take a look at those moderate Republican candidates who haven't done well in the two cycles?
Well, most of them, when they haven't done well, they've been taken out in primaries by more conservative Republicans who then have gone on to lose general elections. And if they didn't lose it the first time around, there's a seat out in Kansas where that happened. The conservative won it, but then he lost the second time around because he was too conservative for the district. So it's one of those things where you might be able to pick up a few seats, but if you look at the turnout from this year's election, the conservatives, the Christian-based conservative vote was larger than ever. Almost 2 million more people who had self-identified as Christian conservatives voted in this election than they had for 4 years ago for George Bush. And we still didn't win, so they're not enough of them.
That's
not to say that you don't want them. Of course you do. You want everybody, but you can't win on the Christian conservative vote alone.
But how do you bridge that gap, though, Governor? Obviously, social issues, people feel very strongly passionate about it. How do you have that conversation now in a way where there's some compromise?
Well, you don't try to compromise on moral issues. That's what makes it so hard. But what you do is you focus on the other issues. As again, in this last election cycle, we saw the number one issue that took people to the polls was the economy. We need to have a plan on the economy. We need to not just be sitting back saying, oh, the Democrats are going to overreach and we'll be there to pick up the pieces. We need to say, look, we'll help you whenever we can, but we're also going to hold our principles and we're going to come up with alternative plans if we think what you're doing is wrong. We're going to be the loyal opposition, as in loyalty to the nation, and focus on those issues. On the social issues, again, you can find areas of compromise, but you cannot just focus on those, because if you do, it's going to be impossible to move forward.
Well, in the era of Gerald Ford and Nelson Rockefeller, Governor Whitman, the base of the Republican Party was viewed to be not these social conservatives. It was more these fiscal, thrifty fiscal Republicans with the kind of international wing of the Republican Party. And it was the, Reagan era that really added these Christian conservatives, and then maybe it's the Karl Rove era that turned them into the base. Is the solution to change back to a situation where the more centrist wing of the party is the base and the Christian conservatives are just one of a number of constituencies?
Well, I certainly believe that, and I would argue that this last election proved that. I mean, we saw it 2 years ago when we lost the Congress the way we did. Again, that if you remember, 4 years ago at the congressional elections, Republicans were thumping themselves on the chest. It was right after I wrote the book, or saying, look at what we've done, and we're going to be here forever now. It's a Republican dynasty. Well, 2 years after that, they had their hat handed to them. So, you know, I would say just exactly the way you expressed it, that the Christian conservatives are an important part of the party, but they're only a part of the party. And the real base is that centrist wing, because Americans in general are not mean-spirited, narrow-minded, litmus test people, and yet that is the way we have allowed the party, the Republican Party, to be defined in Washington.
Governor, who leads that charge, then, for the party? You?
Well, I've been running the Republican Leadership Council for the last few years, and we're focused on those kinds of candidates, but it really should come out of the National Committee. And it's going to be very interesting to see who is elected as chairperson of the National Committee, because that will tell a lot. Right now, there's a kind of inside baseball battle going on over one of the main candidates as to whether or not he's pro-life enough, someone who's been pro-life all his life, but is willing to work with people who aren't. And if the party decides they can't have somebody who will work with both sides, who understands the importance of reaching out across the aisle, even if they're going to get the public's business done, then we don't deserve to be a national party. We don't deserve to be in power.
So if someone that you've just described, if that person does end up leading the national committee, then it's your take that the party's not going to be thinking in a broad manner.
If someone who allows themselves to be totally defined in order to get the position along those social issues, then it's going to be very difficult to reach out and get back the disaffected Republicans. And I can't tell you how many people over this last year have come up to me saying, I've been a Republican all my life. Some of them were former state chairmen, national committee people, saying, I just can't do it. I cannot do it anymore. This emphasis on Christian fundamentalism is not the party that I joined. And the lack of progress in Washington is due to this hyper-partisanship, and part of that hyper-partisanship comes from every issue being defined as a moral issue or a partisan issue, and we are very much to blame. The Democrats are as well. I mean, they have their pressure from the far left, and they have been hyper-partisan, but we're not helping things.
Governor Christine Todd Whitman, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Former governor of New Jersey and former head of the EPA, Christine Todd Whitman, is also the founder of the Whitman Strategy Group, a business consulting firm that specializes in government relations.
And the Republican Party is looking for advice from people other than Christine Todd Whitman.
What the Republican Party needs to do is stop worrying about symbols and start worrying about content. They put H.W. Bush into cowboy boots. They put a woman on the ticket with McCain. It's ridiculous. They need to start looking at the things they're preaching and stop just putting up symbols. America's not that dumb anymore.
You can give the GOP some advice, courtesy of our show, at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
Too many and more people who had self-identified as Christian conservatives voted in this election than they had 4 years ago for George Bush. And we still didn't win, so there are not enough of them.
I did not know that. That's Christine Todd Whitman, former governor of New Jersey and former head of the EPA, talking about the 2008 election. We're always on at The Takeaway, and you can also take us to go every morning with our daily podcast. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway,